Welcome to Pediatric Dentistry from A to T, the podcast that covers all aspects of pediatric dentistry, clinical, business, wellness for dentists, and leading-edge science. It's all right here. And now your host, Dr. Jared Johnson.
Welcome back for another episode of Pediatric Dentistry from A to T. I am Dr. Jared Johnson, and I'm so excited to have you with me. Tonight, I want to talk to you about something that's bothered me for a long time. In July of 2015, there was a publication through Aegeus Dental, The Hall Technique, Serious Questions Remain, published by Theodore Kroll, Constance Killian, and Richard Simonson. And it was an opinion piece, a viewpoint. And I think it hurt a lot of kids, and that's why it's bothered me. Because we need to look and adapt to the future of dentistry. And if we're not looking for new ways to do things and ways to improve our profession, we're not moving forward. And we need to move forward because our world is changing. And I think it's important to look at the science behind things. A lot of things I will talk to you about tonight with the literature that I cite, it's new. They didn't have that information at the time. But when something's new, we need to look into it and gather all the facts before we make an opinion. And tonight's my opinion. I am going to share with you scientific data to support my opinion. And I'm happy to have any of the authors come on and have a discussion with me. I think that would be great if they want to. But I think a lot of things that they said were wrong, but they didn't have the knowledge to know that at the time. So we'll move forward. We'll address all their questions that they pose in the article. If you haven't read the article, it's on Aegeus Dental. You can go read it about the Hall technique, and things have changed. So the first question is probably the toughest question to answer. And the question was, what is the medical model of hiding a bacterial infection within a human tissue rather than eliminating it? And the best example is in the treatment of Helicobacter pylori infection. Current status and future concepts published in the World Journal of Gastroenterology in 2014. And at the time, they were treating this with antibiotics and also drugs like similar to omeprazole. And that's how they're treating this infection, to get rid of it. And they aren't going to eliminate it with that antibiotic completely. Looking at the studies, you can still see there's not anywhere from an eradication rate. It's not 100%, except for one study. So it's important to realize that there are models where we have to live with these bugs. But I think if we look at the differences between soft tissues and hard tissue, especially with teeth, and the data we have on indirect pulp therapy, I think things aren't apples and apples, and I think comparing our dental model necessarily to the medical model isn't 100% accurate representation of what the Hall crown is doing for these kids. I'll also mention that restorations, they do not cure a child from dental caries. They don't eliminate the disease. It's a treatment for the disease. So placing a MO or DO instead of a Hall crown, you're still not curing the child from the disease. I think probably the closest infection or closest treatment we have in dentistry to this is the form of creosote pulpotomy, where we're taking a medicine and that's killing the pulp and killing bacteria too, obviously. But it's causing pulp necrosis. We're leaving necrotic tissue. That's the same argument that Dr. Kroll is arguing that we're doing with the Hall technique. I'm sure he's probably done a form of creosote pulpotomy in his day. I just think we need to look at things with an open mind. When did debridement of dead and dying tissue disappear from the wound healing protocol in medicine? Well, this is in dentistry, it was 1966 when the first article was published on indirect pulp capping. And they did indirect pulp caps on 30 primary molars, and re-entry was performed 93% of the time were bacteria-free, and all 30 of the teeth had hard, shiny dentin. Radiographs showed reparative dentin. This Hall crown is a glorified indirect pulp cap. It is nothing new. We've been doing this since 1966. And you'll even see in our latest journal that I just got this week from the AAPD, we're still studying indirect pulp therapy. This has not gone away. I think it's also important to consider remaining dentin thickness, which we'll get into later. That's a key for me, especially when treatment plan. That's why I think I've been so successful with the Hall crown. The next question is, the measure of success is in so-called, in the research about the Hall technique, is whether the crown stays on the tooth. What difference does that make if the crown is retained, if the child still has an infected tooth and no attempt has been made to heal the youngster? Well, this is opinion again. This is success versus survival. So this is huge in dentistry when we study implants. Success means you have the tooth in the mouth and it doesn't have pathosis or pain or infection. Survival is it's in the mouth and still there. There's a huge difference than that. We need to look at success rather than survival when studying this. And also there's some opinion that was just thrown back into that question. You did make an attempt to heal the kid because you sealed off the cavity from getting substrate, and that starves it and it doesn't continue to grow. It's been reported that in one study the Hall technique is usually performed without preoperative radiographs. When did it become acceptable to provide treatment prior to making a complete diagnosis? I will say I think a radiographs are ideal. A bite wing would be nice to evaluate for the depth of decay, and a periapical can evaluate for the furcation and pulpal pathology. I think radiographs should be obtained prior to discussion of the Hall technique. I think you're going to have higher rates of failure that will occur without radiographs just because you can't assess the amount of remaining dentin thickness that you have. I will also mention that radiographs are a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional object, and there's no way we can be 100% successful even with radiographs. Pathology can take up to 6 to 8 weeks to show bone loss in the mouth. So if you have a situation where it's questionable, I would recommend you place a glass ionomer and have the kid back in 6 to 8 weeks and get a new image and see where they're at. I think even with radiographs, we're still going to have failures. You're still going to have failures with pulpotomies and with indirect pulp therapy, with the class 2s, with class 1s. It's going to happen. That's just the nature of dentistry. Dentistry is hard. I think treating without radiographs puts you at a high risk for a medical legal standpoint. I don't do these without radiographs anymore. We do SDF, glass ionomer if we can, and 3-month recalls. Or if it gets bigger to the point where we need to be more aggressive, in my opinion, clinically, we look at sedation. There's just no way you'd be able to stand in front of a judge and say, so help me understand how the child was uncooperative for a radiograph, but you were able to cement 4 crowns. It just doesn't make sense if you were to get to that point. So I highly encourage you to make radiographs, and if you can't, consider maybe if they need to sedation, or consider placing a temporary filling and see how the kid does, and if it comes back needing sedation, that's okay. If it doesn't, then move forward with your Hall crown. What about the children at risk of subacute bacterial endocarditis or those suffering from any medical condition that makes bacterial infections more critical than immunology competent children? I just say follow the AAPD guidelines. If you have a kid undergoing stem cell transplant or having chemotherapy and they have these deep lesions and it's questionable, it doesn't make sense to put that child at risk for this. Let's use common sense and treat the kid according to the AAPD guidelines and get them to the point where they can safely undergo the treatment that they so deeply need for their medical history. It's common sense. I don't think this has to be a big, big, deep question. I wouldn't push the limit in any kid in my practice that's going to undergo this. Let's follow the data and the information that we have published within our organization. What about the marginal ridges of erupting permanent molars and premolars, engaging the overhang of the crown margins, altering eruption dynamics, and perhaps creating a local environment for caries development? Well, I'll tell you, ectopic eruption is not the Hall Crown problem. Ectopic eruption occurs in the absence of stainless steel crowns in kids without enough room. Ectopic eruption occurs with conventional stainless steel crowns. Ectopic eruption occurs with zirconia crowns. Ectopic eruption can occur with space maintainers. It's important to not cement an oversized crown. I have placed some Hall crowns with better adaptation than I have stainless steel crowns. It can be done if you use the proper technique. How does one rationalize the ethics of non-treatment? That's an interesting question. What dentist of conscience could accept a stainless steel crown fee for entombing caries infection rather than healing it? The Hall technique protocol is beneath the standard of care accepted and established for many decades from the 1950s. This is a lot of opinion, in my opinion. Were implants the standard of care in the 1950s? I don't think so. Were phlebotomies with MTA the standard of care in the 1950s? Don't think that material existed then. Things change. This is a lot of opinion packed into this. And when you ask yourself what dentist of conscience could accept a stainless steel crown fee for entombing caries infection rather than healing it, well, it's me. I can take that. I'll take the money. I'll show you some examples of the sedation fees if we go to general anesthesia to treat the kid and how much money I'm saving the family. That's okay. And I can treat more kids. If I've got kids in my chair that need some restorative and a crown, and there's no difference in the Hall crown and the stainless steel crown, and I can do the MO and the DO and then the crown on the other side and save the parent time off work, the kid time out of school, and there's no difference in outcome, why would I not do that for that child, for that parent, for that family? Why would I not? There is no reason not to do that. And if you look at conventional treatment, the Hall technique or immediate pulpotomy for caries molars, a cost-effective analysis done out of the UK. There were significantly more molars that survived with the Hall technique than conventional restoration at 1 year. Total cumulative costs were lower for the Hall technique than conventional restorative care. And based on the long-term practice-based trial, the Hall technique is more cost-effective than conventional restoration. Let me read that again. Based on a long-term practice-based trial, the Hall technique was more cost-effective than conventional restoration and retained for longer and experienced less complications with lower cost. I am not greedy. If I were greedy, I'd do the Class 2 MO or DO, charge for the sedation, watch it fail, either crown it, extract it, and then charge for a space maintainer. Right? If I wanted the money, I want the best for my patients. I don't want the money. I want them in my chair less so I can see more kids and have a bigger impact on this world that we're in. It just doesn't make sense. My example again, sedation and anesthesia fees from the ADA. Here we have a time and cost analysis of pediatric rehabilitation, general anesthesia in the office settings and hospital settings. Average cost of general anesthesia, just anesthesia, that's not the restorative work that the child needs for the family, $7,303. Deep sedation, IV sedation, $414, and moderate sedation, $100, oral sedation, essentially, or light IV sedation, $150 to $700. Canellis in Iowa did a study in 2000 that found the average charge back then, that's 23 years ago. It was $2,009 was the total charges allowed in the Medicaid program to treat a child under GA. To put this in perspective, GA for medical eligible children under 6 accounts for 25% of Iowa's dental expenditures, despite a significant portion of the budget. However, fewer than 2% Medicaid eligible children receive dental treatment with GA. So if we can avoid this, we're saving our taxpayers money, we're doing better things for the kids if we can do this, And I would just say, you know, insurance is a tough thing to deal with, but bill for what you do. There is no ADA code for a hall crown, like specifically. The best appropriate code is a 2930. And there are even publications in the UK of hall crowns being billed as sealants for high-risk patients under GA. And I've started doing this. Iowa Medicaid covers sealants, and I have high-risk kids, and I'll ask the parent, I can do a crown on this tooth without drilling, and it's going to be a sealant. That's what my intent is for it, because I'm not, there's no decay on the tooth. They're high risk. It's a need. I believe in sealants. Would you like to do that? Yeah? Okay. We'll do it. And I'll do that for the families. And it's worked out. I'd also consider that you document and look at your Medicaid provider manuals for what's appropriate for the crown, and really document why you're doing things. It is so easy to have a template that they're uncooperative, you're trying to reduce medical risk, and I mean, that's, to me, that's enough documentation to say, hey, we're avoiding putting them to sleep, which has risk. I mean, we still have kids, unfortunately, that don't make it through sedation, and it's unfortunate. I mean, there's that in the medical field too, but it's nothing that we want to happen at any of our offices at all. It's just not something to take lightly when we take a kid to anesthesia. We take it very seriously at my office, and if we can avoid it, we can. If we can delay it, we can. We'll do everything we can to avoid putting them in a hospital setting or in a deep sedation setting at our office. The next question is, what are the histopathological implications of leaving necrotic and necrobiotic tissue within a primary molar with associated live alveolar bone underneath, along with a developing maturing premolar? And for that matter, what if there is no succedaneous tooth developing? How can that be assessed with no preoperative radiograph? We already have addressed that. And this is where we can look into the preservation and restoration of tooth structure from Mount's textbook. We have infected dentin and affected dentin, and we have healthy, hopefully, dentin in between if we have enough remaining dentin thickness. And if we look at that in primary teeth, this was done evaluation of pulp tissue in primary second molars that underwent pulpotomies, and they took out the pulp tissue and looked at it histologically, and they found out in primary teeth, this has been repeated again in a second study, but remaining dentin thickness criteria for primary teeth is 80% remaining dentin thickness or 1 millimeter. So if you have that thick band of 1 millimeter of dentin, you're likely going to be very, very successful with this because the bacteria has not reached the pulp. And if it hasn't reached the pulp and you have hard tissue in between the infection and the pulp and it can't grow, there's going to be no harm to the developing tooth. Now, if it's less than that, it becomes necrotic, we can see changes. But I think if we follow the science, and this is actually from 2014, this is before Carl's publication. If we look at succedaneous teeth, we don't always get this on bite wings. I think the first radiographs we usually get on these young three-year-olds with these smaller lesions that are healthier, bite wings. We don't go and make PAs on every single kid to go look for a tooth. It may develop later. We don't typically do panoramics until the first permanent tooth erupts. And I'll say conventional treatment is always an option. Once the kid's cooperative, if you want to remove the hall crown and the cement and do a conventional restoration, you can. I've only had one mom take me up on this at my office in the years that I've been doing this, and I've been doing this a lot, and I always offer it, but they're fine with it after they accept it. And I think honestly probably the best thing, if it's not causing a problem with ectopic eruption or anything else, is to leave it and not put the kid through a poke and another experience that could be negative long term. Are the soft tissue responses to overhanging stainless steel margins of no consequence? What about the chronic gingival inflammatory insult that exists with overhanging artificial margins? And this was debunked by Nicole Innes and her group in the UK. They saw, looked at hall crowns, and they said no change over 1 year period with hall crowns. The gingival index didn't improve, but it didn't get worse. And they also had improved plaque scores. So this is debunked. This is not true. It simply isn't true. Nothing changes. If their poor oral hygiene, their oral hygiene and gingival index stays the same, but they get a better plaque score. The idea that cement and an oversized crown will successfully seal off the caries infection is absurd. What research supports that concept? Well, we have research to support that with indirect pulp therapy. We can even look at success rates of former crucial pulpotomy versus indirect pulp therapy and the treatment of deep dental caries and primary teeth from 2000. Indirect pulp therapy from this, they concluded, was more successful than former creosote pulpotomy, and it was just statistically significant. 93% of the indirect pulp caps were successful, 74% of the pulpotomies were. I will say that the caveat to this study is not all of the teeth treated with pulpotomies had SSCs. So take that with a grain of salt, but we could still be 93% successful is pretty darn good in dentistry. I would hang my hat on that any day walking out working with these teeth. Recently, there was a study out of the AAPD a few years ago, and it looked at hall crowns versus conventional crowns with glass ionomers and RMGIs, and they said that the hall crowns did have more gaps in them. And they found that the crowns did have some leakage, both the stainless steel and the hall crown. But this was not comparing apples and apples. They crimped the conventional crowns, but they didn't crimp the hall crown. There is no reason you can't crimp a hall crown on where you need to. I think if you can make a good fitting crown and get it down, I think you can crimp the distal of an E if the first molar is not in. There's no reason not. I'd also say the location of the cavity. If you've got something that the crown is covering, if a little bit of cement washes out, it's going to be okay. If it's on the occlusal, they'd have to grind through the crown, not have the leakage from, it's not going to leak from the gingival aspect and have come all the way up from from the gingival. Now, if the crown's not down all the way, you know, that can be an issue if you've got a large MO or DO. What are the medical legal implications of the Hall technique? If parents or caregivers pay a fee to have their child healed and the disease entity is covered up and hidden, what are the legal issues and financial concerns that arise with failures and the other teeth that are failing over a long period of time? Well, what if I change that? I'm going to change that. I'll read it again. Few words. What are the medical legal implications of an indirect pulp cap? If parents or caregivers pay a fee to have their child healed and the disease entity is covered up and hidden, what legal issues and financial concerns arise with failures and the other teeth that are failing over a long period of time? I changed one treatment. I changed the Hall technique to the indirect pulp cap. And I would think that looking at the literature, most pediatric dentists support indirect pulp capping. I would be hard to find one that doesn't. I would. I really would. I believe that. And this is treating the disease. It's just a different type of indirect pulp cap compared to one where you remove a little decay and then put your filling in. I really think that this concern is just opinion again. It's a lot of opinion. We have data to support indirect pulp therapy. And I'll say there are risks and costs to sedation. There's failures in dentistry from restorations, pulpotomies, root canals, implants. Nothing's 100%. As long as you get proper informed consent from the parent and explain it to them, and use the correct criteria with your diagnosis, you're going to be successful with it. And if they really want to avoid sedation and you're pushing the limits and they understand that, I would get that written down that this is unfavorable. and let them know the prognosis is, if we do this, is, in my opinion, unfavorable. Yeah, it's a treatment option. It's not the best, but if they're gung-ho on avoiding sedation, I mean, that may be something that you have to walk down that road. And I think that's part of the informed consent. If you're not comfortable also offering the treatment, recommend another opinion. Someone else can do it. Are parents or caregivers being informed that with the Hall method, an infection will remain active in the molars covered with the stainless steel forms? Are those adults responsible for the children given a choice to whether they have such infection should be healed or hidden from view? Whew. Gosh. I think this is another one where it's not active. You're arresting the decay by starving it from eating. If you don't eat, you die. If you don't breathe, you die. How are these bacteria going to continue to proliferate if they don't have substrate? They won't. It's going to be reduced. If you look at all the studies at indirect pulp therapy where they go back and get the colony forming units, it decreases the amount of bacteria that are there, regardless of material that is used. So you're not just hiding the infection. You're treating it by removing the substrate that causes bacteria to proliferate and grow. I think parents should be given all options. We do this at my office all the time. We give them, you know, options of nitrous oxide, IV sedation, general anesthesia, and Hall crowns if they're candidates for it. And you may have parents that you schedule for the hospital that have a lot of needs, and maybe it's a kid that could be treated with Hall crowns, and they wanted to do maybe all zirconia crowns, and they didn't want the silver, and then they get the cost of anesthesia, and they call you back and say, oh, I think we're going to go with those Hall crowns, or the silver crowns that you talked about at the office without the anesthesia. That's going to work better for a family. That's okay. They can change their mind. I would highly recommend that you have an informed consent form for a Hall crown. If you want that, I can provide that to you. I usually tell the parents that, you know, the crown covers the whole tooth, and this cavity will stop getting sugar, and it stops it from growing. It only works if the cavity is not close to the nerve, which I don't think it is in your child's case. Most kids do have some mild to moderate discomfort, similar to if they were to get a band for braces. And, you know, we do need to keep an eye on these over time. If the crown ever comes off, the cavity can start growing again. And if I really feel this way, I'll say I really don't think there's going to be a difference in outcome between this and, you know, a restoration for your child if they're not cooperative. I really don't. So that really helps put it into perspective for a lot of parents and accepts. And you can do these same day once you get more experienced. The last question, I think this is the last one, I'm not sure, but do the proponents of the Hall technique render this shortcut non-repair approach to carious primary molars for children, dentists, physicians, lawyers, microbiologists? How could such unscientific management of a child's healthcare be rationalized to parents who want their children treated safely, correctly, and humanely? Well, I can answer this one because I've been there. I had an anesthesiologist child, and she comes in for a consult. She had a large carious lesion on L, and it, well, was to the point where she didn't have the remaining dentin thickness. And I said, well, your kid's not cooperative. She's got a ton of needs. And, you know, how do you feel about general anesthesia? And she goes, oh, no. And that's what she does for a living. She doesn't want to put a kid to sleep for teeth, but that's what she does for a living. So I said, okay, well, we can do an oral sedation if you want. We can remove this tooth. I don't think she's going to be cooperative for a pulpotomy. Because I said, oh, we can do, you know, sedation with Demerol, hydroxyzine. She goes, no, we're not doing that. And I was like, okay. So then we can do midazolam. She's like, I'm okay with that just because I'm here. Building confidence in me at the time. So we ended up, she hadn't eaten or hadn't even eaten or drank at a time that day. I was starting my office. We ended up getting that tooth out, and we Hall crowned the tooth behind it and got our x-rays of the remaining teeth that we needed. She had some more work to do. So we ended up putting her on 3-month recall, and she ended up with quite a few Hall crowns, and then we eventually got to restore some conventionally as well. But she chose this over anesthesia. And she's well-educated, and that child's doing very well. It's worked well. We had the kid on 3-month recall. We monitored things. We did things when we needed to. And it's been over 5 years. Well, we got some more questions. I wasn't to the end. Have dentists who use the Halt method chosen to do so because it's easier and quicker, therefore more profitable than treating the infected children with proven standard tooth-colored, bonded, restorative materials or correctly placed stainless steel or zirconia crowns? Well, if you look at a sedation appointment, I mean, it's 55 minutes of doctor time. From when you get everything ready to when you discharge the patient. That's a lot of time. If you look at a typical operative appointment, you're looking at 35 minutes of doctor time from when the patient arrives to when the procedure ends and they get dismissed. The Hall crown, if you look at that, say show it's about 12 minutes that you spend. So I can treat more children in an area where no one's taking Medicaid and I'm one of the only Medicaid providers, and there's no difference in outcome. Why would I not want to take care of these kids? We're booked out a few months for care, and if I can do something the same day, if it needs a crown, it needs a crown. That doesn't mean I can't do a Hall crown on it. If it's something that might be able to do a filling on, the kid's cooperative, we'll schedule that out. I'm not going to jump to that right away. Not yet. Not till things change, but which may occur in our lifetime. But there's probably not a difference in outcome. I mean, if you have that reversible pulpitis with 1 millimeter of remaining dent thickness, like, these are slam dunks all day, every day. And if it already needs a crown, there's no reason why I'm going to schedule that kid for local anesthetic and nitrous and conventional crown when I can do it the same day. It's just, why? When I can treat something like a kid that needs a phlebotomy or an extraction. And I think it's just important for us to realize things change. I mean, we just have studies coming out again, which this isn't new to me, but in the APD this month, just a study on irreversible pulpitis and permanent teeth treated with an MTA phlebotomy. Like, that's not new, but that's not what you're taught in dental school. And I think as dentists, we need to keep an open mind and adapt, look at the science, and we do need to be innovative. We do need to try new things. We have to be to continue to grow. And I think, again, in my opinion, I would love to see where these authors stand now with the more evidence that we have, which a lot of it wasn't new. But I think this position paper a long time ago, it really harmed a lot of kids in my mind from preventing dentists from providing this care. And this is such an easy technique to use. It's so comfortable for the kids. We do it almost every day at my office. I would do it on my kid. My wife probably wouldn't like that, but I would, because I believe in it. I've seen it work. And it's just a great tool for you to have and for you to be able to discuss when things aren't going well in an op and it's kind of on the border. Like, if we wait 3 months, this might be a phlebotomy or extraction. You know, maybe, and the kid's not doing well with nitrous, why not just get it done with the crown and move on to live another day and avoid sedation? I think there's multiple ways to do things. If you're not comfortable doing it, that's okay. You don't have to offer this at your office. I just wanted to review some of these questions just because there might be some people out there that may have seen this piece and think, oh my, okay, yeah, they're right. It's just opinion, and I hope I've provided enough science. I don't have all of the answers to their questions. There are some that you'll probably say I didn't give a very good one to, and that's okay. Again, I hope you'll join me. We have a monthly CE coming up here. Looking forward to April. Our Hope for the Day will be coming back. We also have our study club that will be coming out. And then we're going to be doing hands-on in Omaha. If you want to get there and learn with me on 3D printed typodonts, how to do a lot of these techniques with zirconia crown, stainless steel crown, Hall crown, pulpotomies with bioceramics, just a lot of things that have really changed in our field. I'd love to have you there and have you at the event and have a good time with you, enhance your skills and teach you some of the things that I've learned that have made me successful. I'm still trying to get better. This 3D printing thing is kicking my butt right now, but I will figure it out, and I will definitely be putting on some courses with that for you. Thanks again for attending, and we'll look forward to the next show.
Thank you for listening to Pediatric Dentistry from A to T. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss a future episode. For more information or to connect with Dr. Johnson, visit us online at www.pediatricdentalce.com. For more tips and tricks, follow Pediatric Dental Seminars on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.